On Thursday, we read from your emails, and this week we've received quite a few comments about our series on paying for college. Kimberly Romer writes, I was shocked by the self-absorbed families featured in your first story. Nobody is entitled to anything. You have to work for what you want. She continues, nowhere in the story did I hear about any of the students, A, working to contribute to tuition, B, opting to live at home and commute to school, or C, opting for community college. Life is full of brutally difficult choices, and students need to learn this lesson well before college. Rebecca Perez, the student featured in our second story, received a lot of praise. She's the daughter of a Mexican farm worker who's now at Stanford University.
Every day, like, I get up in the morning and I just look at the campus and I say, man, I worked this hard for this luxury. Fountains all over the place. I don't hear traffic. I'm just in this little bubble.
Congratulations to Rebecca, writes listener Leticia Bruce of Brandon, Mississippi. I, too, grew up in a poor family. My father was an immigrant from Mexico. He worked the graveyard shift as a machinist for 25 years to support a family of six. My dream was to go to UCLA, and I knew my family could never afford it. So I worked hard, participated in every academic activity, and searched high and low for every scholarship I could remotely get my hands on. Turning to politics now and our interview with Republican Senator Orrin Hatch about the debate over judicial filibusters. Greg Lim of Austin, Texas writes, I was so furious with the cooing softballs that I ripped the headphones from my ears and nearly fell off the ladder I was painting from. Were you that oblivious to the fact that you were speaking to one of the Senate's chief perpetrators of petty partisanship during the Clinton era? Ask tough questions in your interviews. Have some guts. My conversations with Tom and Joyce DiBaggio brought in a number of letters. Many of you remember the DiBaggios from a series aired on All Things Considered 5 years ago. They spoke with Noah Adams shortly after Tom was diagnosed with early-onset Alzheimer's disease. Thank you for this report, writes listener Carol Zanilotti. I've often wondered about how Tom was progressing. Then, as I was coming home from work, there he was, still alive, a mere shadow of the man I had first heard, but still here and doing the best he could to keep a grasp on reality. My tears came, but I also felt hope for him. Electra Greer had a different reaction. I found the latest installment to be disturbing for reasons far beyond its content. As important as it is to give insight into the tragedy of Alzheimer's, your approach is beginning to feel exploitative and manipulative. Forgive the imperfect analogy, but your listeners are not callow adolescents in need of a modern-day Flowers for Algernon. We and the DiBaggio family deserve more respect than that. Finally, comments on our colleague Robert Siegel's interview with truck driver and bounty hunter turned opera singer Carl Tanner. Listener Art Spears of Farmington Hills, Michigan writes, I'm surprised nobody mentioned or played the folk song by Harry Chapin called Mr. Tanner. It's about a simple man from a small town who yearns to be an opera singer. Mary Eisenfeld adds, the Mr. Tanner of Harry Chapin's song was shattered by the reviews of the critics and never sang again. How perfect is it that the real-life Mr. Tanner pays them no mind and sings for his audience and himself? Well, we usually don't do requests, but here's a little taste of Harry Chapin's Mr. Tanner.
And he sang from his heart, and he sang from his soul. He did not know how well he sang, it just made him whole.
We want to hear from you. Write to us at atc@npr.org. And when you do, please remember to tell us where you live and how you pronounce your name.
His friends kept working on him to try music out full time.
One final note, there's been some disagreement and confusion about the hometown of one of our commentators, Carol Wasserman. One of her essays aired on Tuesday. The town is spelled W-A-R-E-H-A-M. And if you go to the Merriam-Webster Online Dictionary, you can click and hear this pronunciation for the town in southeast Massachusetts.
Wareham.
Wareham. No audible H. But our fearless producer, Franklin Cater, wasn't satisfied, so he started working the phones.
Thank you for calling the Wareham Free Library. Please listen carefully.
Hello, you have reached the Wareham Town Hall. Our office hours are
Wareham Police.
My name is Franklin Cater. I'm with NPR in Washington. And who do I have here on the phone?
Sergeant Jacinto.
Okay, Sergeant. And you're with the police department there, and tell me the name of the town.
Wareham.
Wareham.
W-A-R-E-H-A-M.
Terrific. Thank you very much.
Okay.
What's the name of the store that you work for?
Wareham Country Market.
How long have you lived in the town there?
15 years.
15 years.
Yes.
Does pretty much everybody in town say the name of the town the same way?
Basically, yes.
Are there some newcomers who get it wrong?
Yes.
But you're telling me it's the H is definitely not silent, right?
Right.
So, once again, if you wouldn't mind just telling me the name of the town.
Wareham.
Well, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Carol, why don't you just tell me, since in the never-ending search for truth as journalists, we are constantly questioning the name of your town, and mm-hmm. it seems to run counter to somehow our intuition here at NPR. If you could just tell me your name and the name of the town that you live in.
My name is Carol Wasserman, and I live in the completely counterintuitive town of Wareham, Massachusetts. Wareham.
So until we can master Wareham, we'll be going with Wareham, not Wareham.